The Messiah Rejected.
Good morning, everyone. Well, in this address about the Messiah Rejected, our first step has got to be, quickly and briefly, to trace the process of rejection as it's revealed to us by Matthew in his Gospel. And then, afterwards, we shall seek to retrace our steps and look at some of the evidence more incisively. So, let's begin at the beginning and begin to notice where the first signs of rejection occur and emerge in the Gospel of Matthew. Now, let me explain what I'm going to do. I shall refer to certain incidents in progression through the Gospel. I shall quote the chapter and verses numbers, but I shall not read the passage itself. That is because I shall be taking out of it the salient points, giving the verse numbers, and in any case, if I read each passage through each time, well, this address would be far too long. And so, I hope you'll go along with me on that, and I think you'll follow it all right, but I'm going to quote the references clearly for your sakes, if you're taking notes, and for the sake of anybody who listens to the tape afterwards. Well, now, the first sign of rejection of the Messiah occurs, according to Matthew, in the 9th chapter, a chapter you remember, which we looked at already, and it came through an incident we have already considered. It's chapter 9 of Matthew, verses 2-8, the case of the paralyzed man. Now, the king was a man who always measured the physical in terms of the spiritual. He heard the birds sing and said, God feeds them. He saw the flowers on the hillside and said, God clothes them. He handled a common loaf and said, there is a bread that men may eat and not taste of death forever. And so it was with this palsied man. He saw a connection between the physical and the spiritual. The man was burdened by his sin. Christ knew it. He dealt with the evil out of which the man's limitation had come. And in verse 2 he said, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins are forgiven thee. Now, the measurement of the scribes upon that is in verse 3. This man blasphemeth. Let's notice carefully their estimate of Jesus. They here regarded him as a blaspheming rabbi. Now, we shall have need to return to this ere long, but this was the first rupture with the leaders according to Matthew. Then later on in Matthew 9, in verses 10 to 15, the Pharisees are objecting that Jesus was consorting with publicans and sinners. And the reply of the Messiah, with unanswerable logic, it's in verse 12, they that be whole need not a physician, but they that be sick. And goes on in verse 13, but go ye and learn what this meaneth. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners unto repentance. Well, now, they could not have liked that, and it must have started a kind of nursing resentment against him. Well, still in Matthew 9, verses 32-34. In that passage, there's record of how Jesus heals a dumb man possessed with the devil. And the Pharisees' reaction to that, verse 34, he casteth out devils through the prince of devils. Now, diabolism, under Jewish law, is a very serious charge indeed. You need to notice it at this stage, because it marks a development in the estrangement which is taking place. Next, we come on to Matthew 12, verses 1-8. Now, this is the case of the disciples rubbing out the corn in their hands on the Sabbath day. The Pharisees objected to this, as you know. They objected to what these disciples were doing, on the grounds that it was not something which was lawful to be done on the Sabbath. They would say that they were threshing the corn. Now, the reply of the king must have been particularly galling for them. I want you to notice it. In verse 3 he said, have ye not read what David did? And then in verse 5, Have ye not read in the law? Or in verse 7, if he had known what this meaneth, he would not have condemned the guiltless. Now you just think about that. To be rebuffed by an appeal to the very law in which they were experts. It's like a layman, in a way, going to a lawyer's office and saying, "Now, don't you know the law about..." Well, you know, he'd take umbrage, wouldn't he? And that's what's happening here, you see. They were rebuffed by this appeal to the very law in which they were the acknowledged experts. That must have touched their professional pride. And then there was this final thrust. The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. Still in Matthew 12, verses 9 to 14. Now this is the case of a man with a withered hand. And as you know, Jesus cured him in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. And he argued that they would have a sheep on the Sabbath day, and if the sheep was in trouble, they would save it. And if it was right to save a sheep, why was it wrong to save a man? Now, you can understand that they couldn't really get away from the fact that the action of Jesus was justified by their own behavior on the Sabbath. You just think about that. How embarrassing it was. His action was justified, not by himself. His wrong action, as they saw it, was justified by them. It was their behavior that justified his action. He said, "You save sheep, God knows it must be right to save men." So notice the outcome in verse 14. When the Pharisees went out, they held a council against him, how that they might destroy him. Well, now you can see the opposition is taking a much more sinister direction. Secretly, they are saying, "We have had enough. He must go." Still in Matthew 12, verses 22 to 30. In this passage, there's a record of Jesus casting out the demons of blindness and dumbness. And the Pharisees heard it. And you'll see in verse 24, they said that it was done through the work of Beelzebub, the prince of devils. Again, a charge of diabolism. Very serious under Jewish law. Then still in Matthew 12, verses 38 to 42, certain of the scribes and Pharisees are seeking a sign from Jesus. And his reply indicts them squarely. It's in verse 39, "An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall be no sign given to it, but the sign of the prophet Jonas." Now, just think of the words carefully. The word adulterous is not very nice, is it? I mean, the word adulterous must have upset them deeply. For they knew that it was the very word which is used in the Old Testament to describe the very lowest condition of the people of God when they had departed from their high calling into their very worst condition of degradation and infidelity. This is the word that is used, adulterous. In other words, a spiritual harlot. You can understand then how they must have resented that. Adulterous. And so, as they had refused every other sign, said Jesus, they must wait now for the sign of Jonah. The sign of Jonah, mark you, a man who came out of death in order to proclaim the word of salvation. We pass on now to Matthew 15, verses 1 to 20, a long passage. Now this is interesting, Matthew 15 verses 1 to 20, because here we have a special deputation of Pharisees and scribes coming from Jerusalem to inquire, so it seems, about the teaching of the man from Nazareth. They are coming to make an inquiry. Now, they were concerned about washing hands, and the Messiah's reply revealed that they really ought to be concerned about how they selfishly shattered the second commandment, honour thy father and thy mother. We've already gone over this. By their tradition, they made God's commandment, they nullified it by their tradition. They set it aside. And so, here was a conflict between their tradition and the truth of God. And you'll notice in verse 12, the disciples said, the Pharisees were offended. That was the disciples' estimate. I should say myself, that was putting it rather mildly. They were offended. I should say they were livid. They must have been livid, because he called them hypocrites. And what's worse, he used Isaiah to prove it. One of their own prophets. He used the prophet Isaiah to prove that their worship of the God of Israel was false. Oh, they must have been livid. Matthew 16, verses 1 to 5. This time the Pharisees joined with the Sadducees to try to tempt Jesus. It's in verse 3 that he says that they can discern the signs of the weather, but they are blind to the signs of the times. And again, it calls them hypocrites and leaves them. Now we come on to Matthew 21, verses 12 to 17. Matthew 21, verses 12 to 17. And in this passage, Matthew reveals that the king moves to Jerusalem to enter the city as a king in fulfillment of the prophecy of Zechariah. Now, we've been over this already, as you know. And then he moves to the temple of God, clears out the forces of pollution and corruption. The blind and the lame are healed. The children proclaim the Messiah. And as I said before, for an hour, the kingdom of heaven is there in the center of the city of God. And it says, the priests were sore displeased. I reckon that's a polite way of saying they were very angry. You see, they are now angry men ready to do mischief. Still in Matthew 21, verses 23 to 27, the chief priests and the elders challenge the authority of the king. In verse 25, he counters by asking them to declare themselves concerning John the Baptist. Now, you will know, my comrades, that this was a very clever, a very incisive question. It reveals the wisdom of the Messiah. It was a very telling question, because if they admitted that John was true and he came from God, they had to admit that so was Jesus. For John was Jesus' herald, and John testified to his authority. Imagine the situation. If they said, yes, this man was from God, and it was this man that testified of Jesus, the Messiah. You can see how awkward it was. Because to accept one made it illogical to reject the other. When John ceased, Jesus took up the ministry. Now, they saw the dilemma. They were biting their nails. And as people very often do when they're in a dilemma, they gave a dishonest answer. They said, "We know not." An admission of willful blindness. And what must have made them so angry was that they were forced into it. They tried to trap him and he was too clever for them. If you'll forgive the word clever. He forced out of them an admission of their willful blindness. "We know not." They knew. Of course they knew. What a shambles it was, wasn't it? To be forced to admit ignorance about something that they should have been certain of. Can you imagine how angry they were? Well, now we come on to Matthew 23. And this is the famous chapter about the Pharisees, isn't it? It scorches, this chapter. You need asbestos, really. It contains a terrible indictment by the Messiah of the religious leaders of Israel. I'll quickly remind you, he calls them blind guides, fools, hypocrites, whited sepulchres, murderers of the prophets with blood on their heads, serpents, and the offspring of vipers. How about that for a start? The terrible words are spoken in deep sorrow, for the passage ends with the king weeping over the city, which had been brought to reject its king by the very forces which he had been compelled to condemn with such telling and awful damnation. "Woe unto you," he said, time and time again, didn't he? "Woe unto you." And you can be sure, my comrades, that when he said it, his voice was choked with tears. "Woe unto you." And then the outcome of this, or the final outcome of this awful indictment of the rulers, is discovered in Matthew 26, verses 1 to 5. We'll read that. Matthew 26, verses 1 to 5. "And it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these words, he said unto his disciples, Ye know that after 2 days the Passover cometh, and the Son of Man is delivered up to be crucified. Then were gathered together the chief priests and the elders of the people unto the court of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas. And they took counsel together that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, Not during the feast, lest a tumult arise among the people." So the developing campaign of hatred at last came to its climax. They resolved to kill him, because for them there was no other remedy. And so the Messiah is rejected by his own people. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. Now, there are many questions which emerge from the consideration of how the Messiah was rejected, but there is one which I feel we ought to pursue more intensely in the interest of seeking to understand Matthew's Messiah. And the question is this: why were the Pharisees and the scribes and the priests and the rulers so blameworthy and so culpable and so deserving of such awful condemnation? Why was it? Why were they so deserving of this awful condemnation by the Messiah? Now, in pursuit of that, I want to bring you back to one of the incidents that we recollected already, the case of the man with a withered arm. Come back, please, to Matthew chapter 12. And let's read from verses 9 to 14. And Jesus departed thence and went into their synagogue, and behold, a man having a withered hand, and they asked him, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him? And he said unto them, What man shall there be of you that shall have one sheep, and if this fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is a man of more value than a sheep? Wherefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. Then said he to the man, Stretch forth thy hand. And he stretched it forth, and it was restored whole as the other. But the Pharisees went out and took counsel against him, how they might destroy him. Notice the details carefully. This is a crucial incident because the outcome was a clear resolution on the part of the Pharisees to destroy Jesus. I'm now going to take advantage of that little provision I made right at the beginning of this series to turn to another gospel just occasionally to illuminate something in Matthew. I bring you next to Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3 and just the first two verses. It's the same incident, you see, but there's something I want you to notice. Mark chapter 3 then, and he entered again into the synagogue, and there was a man there which had his hand withered, and they watched him whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. The phrase I want you to notice is, and they watched him. That's important. It says they were watching him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath day. Now, it was probable that this paralyzed man was a regular visitor to the synagogue. Perhaps he'd been coming for years. Evidently, they knew that he would be there on the Sabbath day because he was there every Sabbath. The man with the withered arm. They knew that the man of Nazareth was coming too. Indeed, he was being set up. This was, if you'll pardon the expression, a frame-up. He was being set up on this particular Sabbath. It was all arranged, you see. They wanted to trap him and they wanted to ensnare him that they might accuse him. It says so. Now, this was their master plan. I dare say that the man had been guided, this man with the withered arm had probably been guided by the serving brother, if you'll pardon the expression, been guided by the serving brother to a place where he would be in the synagogue so that he would come face to face with the Nazarene in such a way as to make his disability very evident. You see, what is so interesting here is the thinking of the Pharisees. They were saying to themselves, if only we can get this disabled man into the presence of this man from Nazareth, it's almost certain that he will want to heal him, that he will attempt a cure, and then we should be able to have him. Just mark it well, the success of their plan rests solidly on their acknowledgement that if this man from Nazareth is confronted with a sick man, he would not be able to resist, would not be able to restrain his compassion, even though it was the Sabbath day. They depended on Jesus being true to his calling in order for their plan to succeed. Of all the people in the synagogue, they knew that Jesus was the most dependable when it came to helping somebody. He was the most compassionate when it came to helping the undone. And so they were saying, and I believe they were saying it with a chuckle, he will never be able to resist it. We're chuckling. The trap is set. Is it not interesting, brethren and sisters, what an accurate estimate of Jesus they had formed. What a telling estimate of his character, of the Messiah's character they had formed. And what a compliment they were paying to him without intending to. Well, we know what happened. He challenged them and said, Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day or to do evil? Well, they said nothing. I mean, they didn't wish to discourage him because they wanted him to do good. But on the other hand, they didn't want to be accused afterwards of encouraging him. So they said nothing. The true answer, of course, would have been, it is right to do good and it's wrong to do evil. But they wouldn't bear that testimony. So he said to the poor broken man, stand forth. And then with one superb command, he gave him ability for his disability. The man surrendered, the power was communicated. Matthew says the hand was restored whole as the other. Well, the poor man must have been delighted, wouldn't you? All the years of paralysis ended in one blinding flash on the Sabbath day, the day that God made for man. And Jesus must have been well pleasing. He'd been able to do the work of God on God's day, to turn weakness into power, to turn sorrow into joy, uselessness into usefulness. And is it an interesting thing? Everybody was glad. Isn't that nice? Everybody was glad. The poor man was glad, Jesus was glad, and guess who were glad? You're right. The Pharisees were glad too. Of course they were. But for different reasons. They were glad because their hope of the Nazarene had been fulfilled. He had proven true to their estimate of him. They depended upon him to do good. They depended upon him to heal. And he healed and he'd restored. And their gladness was centered in the possibility of doing harm to the cause of the man who was claiming to be the Messiah. Their joy was in the chance to accuse him and to destroy him. They were glad that he had violated the Sabbath as they saw it. They would have been disappointed if he had conformed to their view of doing right. They would have been disappointed. It shows that they weren't really interested in the upholding of right at all. They were not really concerned that God's law should be respected. The overriding desire was that this man should be in a position where he could be indicted and destroyed. They were glad that, measured by their measurement, evil had been done. They were not glad for the poor paralyzed man. That he had been cured was to them of no consequence whatever. That half a lifetime of withered paralysis had been ended gave them no thankful satisfaction. No wonder Jesus was angry. No wonder. Mark says he was very angry. And Mark says also that he was grieved for the hardness of their heart. It was the same with the man, you remember, who was healed at the pool of Bethesda. They complained that the man had carried his bed on the Sabbath day and therefore was labouring. They were not concerned that 38 wintry years of hopelessness had been ended. And so it is here at this occasion. The real blameworthiness and the real culpability of these men lies in the fact that they recognize that this man of Nazareth was doing what they was doing good and was saving the broken and bruised and the bereft, and they depended upon his compassion and they recognized his sympathetic understanding for those in need. They admitted really that he was a man of love and mercy and kindness. And in the face of that, they rejected him and they condemned him. That was their culpability. In the presence of the light, they preferred darkness. Even at the last, when he was brought to the cross by their conspiracy, as he was hanging on the cross, they taunted him and they said, he saved others, himself he cannot save. Even in their attempt to mock him, they had to conceive that he had saved others. They couldn't get out of it. He had saved others, they said. So I submit to you that this was their awful responsibility, and it is fixed in one word in the record in Mark 3. He calls it the hardness of their heart. Hardened hearts result in deceived hearts. In the presence of the best and the noblest and the purest and the most compassionate exhibition of divine life, these men hardened their hearts. They admitted it, they depended upon it, and they rejected it. Now this is their awful indictment and their awful condemnation. This was their terrible sin. They loved darkness rather than light. And it was intensified by the fact that their high principles could be violated so easily when it suited them. Men of high principles? Not really. Men who talked of high principles and lived on low ones. This is the very point that Jesus made. He said, "What man shall there be of you that shall have one sheep, and if it shall fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will not lay hold on it and lift it out?" Notice the words carefully. What man that hath one sheep? The argument is that you rescue it because it is yours, that hath. It is your sheep and you rescue it because it's yours. You are the owner, and because you are the owner, you say there is nothing that stands in the way of recovering your own that is in danger, even on the Sabbath day. Now notice the implication. How much better is a man than a sheep? What he means is, what you do for your sheep on the Sabbath day, God does for his sheep on the Sabbath day. What you do for your sheep on the Sabbath day, God does for his own on the Sabbath day. What you recover on the Sabbath, he recovers for himself, whether it's the Sabbath or not. Now this is part of their blameworthiness. They were willing to deny God what they insisted on for themselves. And the answer to their hardness and to their selfishness and to their hypocrisy is in one solemn sentence ringing through the synagogue. Stretch forth thy hand. Let's now come to the final incidents in the long process of the rejected Messiah. When you think, brethren and sisters, of your great American Constitution, which gives protection and justice to all those who are accused under the law, there is perhaps in your mind one word which expresses comprehensively the forces of its great provisions. I think that word ought to be equity, the very spirit of the great American Constitution, equity. Now when we turn to the case of the man of Nazareth and the methods used by his accusers, there is one word which comes to mind to express the process by which he was tried, and that word is perversion. You know, Brother Melville Perkis, in his book A Life of Jesus, he proves that everything about the trial of the Messiah was illegal. The arrest, the trial itself, the cross-questioning, the evidence, it was all illegal. The provisions to ensure justice for the Jews who were accused before the court, all those provisions were violated. The Roman trial was better, it was more regulated, because under Roman law there had to be an accusation, there had to be a cross-examination, then a defence, and after that the verdict was given. Now in the trial before the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, you know that the witnesses made a bad showing. You know that. They contradicted one another. And Caiaphas must have been fed up, to put it mildly. He was on edge. He said to Jesus, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it that these witness against thee?" And then, regaining his composure, he finds a way out of his dilemma. Never mind that it might well have been contrary to the law. In a loud voice he says, "I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." And you know the reply of the king. He said, "Thou hast said," which means thou hast said the truth. "And hereafter thou shalt see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." And then it says, "Caiaphas rent his clothes," which was an outward sign. It's funny how people rent their clothes in those days, isn't it? Thank God we don't do it today. But Caiaphas rent his clothes, which, as I say, was an outward sign of of inner shock and sadness. That's what it's supposed to be. Of course, there was no real sadness at all. Underneath the clothes of Caiaphas, there was a great deal of satisfaction. He said about the Messiah, "He hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye?" And the answer was a foregone conclusion. He is worthy of death. And the trial was over. But the important thing to mark is that the accusation was blasphemy. Notice that. This is why he was accused, and this is why he was condemned, blasphemy. What we have to do now is to look a little more incisively at the forces behind the accusation to see what really was driving this man, the high priest, to indict and condemn the man of Nazareth, who we know to be the best and the noblest and the kindest man that ever lived. Remember something they said in the council once. What do we, they said, for this man doeth many miracles, and if we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans will come and take away both their place and nation. And then from that day forth they took counsel together for to put him to death. So there we've touched the reality. They concluded that if this teaching and if this man progressed, their reign was over. His teaching made religion a thing of the heart and not just of rabbinical learning. His teaching brought the sinner close to God, brought the broken spirit within reach of the healing compassion of God's love. And this made nonsense, of course, of that ritual regularity which erected a barrier between the sinner and the love of God. Their condemnation of Jesus was spoken in these words: "This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them." What a splendid thing it is, isn't it? They said it to condemn him. Why, it's the finest thing about him. This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them. So let's mark it well. The real ground of opposition to Jesus was hatred of the light. But we've seen that it was not the reasons they put forward. Eventually, their reasons for doing it will be public zeal, patriotism, loyalty. Of course, that's nothing new, but in this case it was intensified. I mean, what could be purer and more godly than to root out an influence which blasphemed the holy name of God? What more noble a calling than to protect the nation and save it, save the inheritance? Well, it sounds splendid, doesn't it? But we know it was all hollow and empty and superficial. The real accusation was that this man was a danger, as they saw it, to their position, their influence, and their power. The purpose is the destruction of the man of Nazareth, but Caiaphas, he justifies it, he justifies his action for the very loftiest of reasons. If you remember, it is expedient, he said, that one man should die than that the whole nation should perish. Not. A great truth spoken really in words of shameful falsehood. Well, let's pass on to the Roman part of the trial. They took their prisoner to Pilate early in the morning. And although it was very early in the morning, Pilate was up. He was up and about. Now, I think he was up and about because he knew they were coming. It is to me fascinating to try to estimate human nature as it's revealed in characters exposed in the Word of God. Now, I don't propose to go over all the details of the interrogation because you know them well. Let's notice how the accusation changed in the course of their journey from the house of Caiaphas to the place of Pilate. Let's notice how it changed. In the Jewish court, it was blasphemy, but they knew very well that old Pilate wouldn't stand for that. And so they had to change it. Luke tells us, we found this fellow, this is what they said, Pilate, "We found this fellow perverting the nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ the King. He stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place." So now the accusation has changed. It started out as blasphemy, but now it's sedition. I mean, blasphemy Pilate could well have ignored. He wouldn't bother about blasphemy. But sedition, of course, is quite another matter. So he examines Jesus, but is unconvinced that he is a rebel or even dangerous. As we examine the motives of Caiaphas, quickly we must examine the motive of Pilate. What a sadly strange man he is. A melancholy example of vacillation and instability. He was strong in the sense that he had power. He was utterly weak in the sense that he was cruel, selfish, and cowardly. Power, used in conjunction with those things, nearly always ends in disaster. Power may corrupt, but it corrupts more those who are already polluted. Notice his vacillation. First of all, he blames the priests. And then he admits that he, after all, is responsible. Then he washes his hands. And then he says, "Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee?" He pronounces Jesus innocent. And then he hands him over to be crucified. Of course, we've heard all this kind of thing before. He is a man knowing what is right, but doing what is wrong. I know about that, so help me God. But why is he so pitiably weak? Because there are things in his own life, you see, which are tying his hands. There was his past guilt. Do you know about that? There was his past guilt and his past failure. He'd come under censure before from the emperor. And he had to be careful now. He didn't want any extra trouble. He didn't want to do anything to invite more trouble. These circumstances, you see, have in them evident causes of personal danger for himself. He's walking a tightrope. After all, a man must think of himself sometimes. He wanted to do right, but he couldn't. It's happened since. Sometimes men know what is right and what they ought to do, but they don't do it because to do so would reveal them as hypocrites. Sometimes men that know they ought to speak out for the truth boldly, but they don't do it because if they did, their words would seem to be like empty platitudes, because people who heard them know what they're like. Think of the agony of it in the case of Pilate. He knew why they delivered the men of Galilee. Matthew 27 verse 18 tells us. It says he knew that for envy they had delivered him. He knew he ought to release him, but for reasons of self-interest and for reasons of self-preservation, he dare not. Sometimes men have to do what is right and take the consequences. But to the vacillating man who is beset by fear, all things seem to be in a flux. All things are alterable, changeful, unfixed. And so he parleyed, and he argued, and he debated, until the verdict of his own intellect was absolutely in a turmoil. He had listened to the priests, he had listened to the people, he had listened to his own wife, he had listened to Jesus, and then with that cheerlessness of soul which sometimes descends upon those who conclude that nothing is certain, he says, and I believe he said it with a sigh, "What is truth?" It wasn't spoken as a jest. It wasn't even spoken to gain information. It was spoken, I believe, in scepticism and despair. You see, any man who violates his conscience in a way is a man in tormented perplexity. His conviction was that Jesus was innocent. He knew the Pharisees were persecuting a guiltless man. He knew that the claims to royalty was nothing like sedition. The charge and the accusation, by Roman standards, had utterly failed. He was a Roman procurator. He saw it, he knew it, and then he tried to get rid of his clear duty. He washed his hands. It was no good. It's like Macbeth. Out, out, damned spot! There is nothing, there is no detergent, my friends. There is no detergent for that. And he knew it. The accusers were vocal. They were insistent. They did not like the candor of this Roman governor about the suspected man. And so, just as it was in the case of the Sanhedrin trial, at the moment when the verdict seemed to be in doubt, when things were going wrong perhaps, they played their trump card. They said, "If thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend." Well, of course, Pilate saw through their blackmail, but he was powerless to resist it. You might think at first sight that, as you read it, you might get the impression that Pilate was the judge and Jesus was the prisoner. But the real truth is that Jesus was the judge and Pilate was the prisoner. But the truth will be pondered at your leisure. Now we must remember this. Pilate pronounced sentence and became a man for the ages to pity and the world to despise. A man whose name and whose fortune has been memorialized in one short sentence, and it has fallen from a million lips all down the ages. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. And so he went out, this man, and pronounced sentence upon the man of unblemished life, the man who was born to be king. And thus the Messiah was rejected.